Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman.
And today we are joined by our special guest and good friend, Craig Bellis, expert in all matters of legal interest to all of us. And he's going to help us look at what transpired with the Continental Army created in 1775. So, Craig, welcome. It's nice to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So today we are indeed looking at the Continental Congress creating the Continental Army on June 14th, 1775. It was formed in response to the growing tensions with Great Britain, particularly after the battles of Lexington and Concord. It was the primary military force of the 13 colonies during the Revolutionary War. It also supplemented by local militias and volunteer troops that were either loyal to individual states or otherwise independent. George Washington was appointed as the commander-in-chief on June 15th, 1775, which was before independence. He accepted command of the army 2 weeks later, on July 2nd, 1775. He led the army throughout the war, facing numerous challenges, including supply shortages and troop discipline. Many of the founding fathers of the United States were suspicious of standing militias, something we may even feel like today. As Samuel Adams wrote in 1768, "Even when there is a necessity of the military power, within a land a wise and prudent people will always have a watchful and jealous eye over it." Even more forceful words are the words of Elbridge Gerry, a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, who wrote that "standing armies in time of peace are inconsistent with the principles of republican governments, dangerous to the liberties of a free people, and generally converted into destructive engines for establishing despotism."
In there, it's important to remember, you know, when the founding fathers are talking about republican, they're talking about a republic form of government, not a political party.
Correct.
And so he's warning against, just in terms of a democracy or republic, needs to be very cautious of a standing
army. It's a small R Republican.
Yes,
not
right.
A big R.
Yeah, you know, although big R may be applicable today.
And it, nevertheless, okay, the Continental Army was created, served throughout the war under General Washington, and was mostly disbanded after the Treaty of Paris in 1783. Its creation, traditions, and principles were the foundation for what we all know today as the U.S. Army. And a lot of those traditions very much carry on with how the Army is operated, celebrates, and observes its successes.
And if I can jump in here,
yeah,
just a second, too. I mean, we'll talk more later on when we talk about the Constitutional Convention, you know, the writing of the Constitution, sort of the Federalist Papers, about these debates. But essentially, you know, the Army is really not mentioned much in the Constitution as a military force. And so it's really by practice that we've arrived at what we have, rather than by sort of constitutional fiat.
Well, and if you look at the formation, it was done out of necessity, not out of desire.
Yeah, and it was done before we were a country.
Yeah.
You know, so we weren't even, you know, a nation yet, and yet we had this army, you know, fighting to create a nation.
Those guys in the red coats were putting pressure on us. So the concept of military, of a military subordinated to civilian control, means that the military is thereby subject to the rule of law, a civilian creation to serve the civilian government, not a political leader or political party. So over the next 250 years of American history, what are some of the most significant events that echo these ideals?
Well, I think important to, again, as I mentioned just earlier, important to put it in context that this is kind of an evolving concept of the relationship between the military and the government. And I think Richard Cohen, who's a historian at the University of North Carolina, remarked, he said, civilian control of the military is not a fact, but a process. And so it's really putting it in that context of it's an evolving sort of a relationship and an evolving ideal about what is the military, what is the civilian, and how does the civilian control the military in an American sort of democracy?
Yeah, Bruce, you're right. I mean, the entire Constitution is set up in order to avoid the centralization of power in any one group. Of course, the Constitution, as you just mentioned, doesn't really talk about a standing federal army. It talks more about the legislature, the executive, the judiciary. Those are the main branches that everything is set up about. But the other thing is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are efforts to put limitations on federal power. And as John, you said a moment ago, the founders were really cautious, chary, if you will, about letting the a military be able to intrude, if you will, into the law enforcement at the local level. I mean, Posse Comitatus, the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, literally is interpreted as the power of the county or the power of the sheriff. And the theory was you want to have law enforcement that deals with people every day on a local level and not run by a president or a general or whatever the case may be, one individual. So they came up with this act in 1878, which is really a firewall built to separate two very different worlds, the world of the U.S. military designed to fight foreign enemies and the world of domestic law enforcement responsible for keeping the peace at home.
So then would our police and sheriff locally, would they fall under this act?
No.
I always think of this as more of a militia.
Well, I know. Thing. We think of a posse.
Yeah.
And states have their own Posse Comitatus Acts, which are more in line with what you're thinking of as to when you can and can't put together a posse. California, if I remember right, I think is like 12 separate statutes on when you can have a posse. Well, that's the Wild West, you know.
California.
No, this is really a true limitation on the ability of the federal military, specifically the Army and the Air Force, and now the Space Force, which just came out of the Air Force, from engaging in local police activities, law enforcement activities. Which, of course, begs many questions as to what is local, you know, authority in that regard. So where is that line? And the line is being pushed and pushed and pushed right now.
So. But Craig, also that whole concept of, you know, limiting the ability of the military to be used in local law enforcement, which is the core of that sort of act, comes from that fundamental fear at the beginning of the Constitution of a strong central government. And when we get the Articles of Confederation, they are so weak that the government can't function, and so the Constitution comes out of that. And yet the fear is that the Constitution, the federal government, is going to be too strong and overwhelm the state government.
Exactly. And you know, it's interesting that I think the feeling early on was so strong that we didn't want to have a standing army getting involved in local law enforcement, that it wasn't even included.
Right.
There wasn't even a statute until 1878 on the subject when they felt that it's becoming more and more necessary. That, of course, arose out of the Reconstruction.
Right.
I'm not sure if you want to talk about that right now or not. But,
oh, yeah, yeah. Sure. I mean, the use of the U.S. Army after the Civil War to enforce, you know, Reconstruction in the South, is a slap in the face of states' rights in the eyes of many, even many Northerners at the time, and of course in the South. I mean, it gives the rise to the sort of glorious cause of the Civil War, and it still is with us today. You know, when you see protesters carrying Confederate flags, you know, it's an echo of what all that was about in that post-Civil War Reconstruction era.
But the great irony of this statute is that it was enacted as a compromise to satiate the Southern Democrats. And I use the term with a big D,
mm-hmm.
Right. Different Democrats than you have today. But they did not want the army coming into the South to prevent prejudice, bias, and discrimination. They didn't want that. So they got this law passed to stop the army from coming in to enforce the rights of slaves who are now free. That's the origination of this, along with the history of the prior 100 years of what people wanted when they wrote the Constitution. The strange hybrid mix, and now we come today where it's used just sort of the opposite.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of an echo of the big R Republicans and the big R Democrats in the 1860s and 1870s in this sort of post-Civil War period. You know, the big R Republicans are Lincoln Republicans, and they're very much in favor of civil rights and African-American rights in the South. Mm-hmm. The big D Democrats are the old Southerners. They're basically the people who led the Confederacy and then come back into the government. And today, those things have flipped in the same way that this view of the use of the military has flipped.
Right.
And it's interesting, my wife went to high school with a fellow who became a brigadier general or whatever the next one is, up, and he's frequently interviewed by CNN and all the talking heads. He and a group of retired generals are very concerned about where we are today. And I'm really curious to know if these guys are doing something in the background. But I get the feeling he's anybody in that position is a bit of an academic, but he's a smart fellow, and they're very, very concerned about what's happening today.
Well, because at the base of that is when you enter the military, when you're sworn in as an officer in the American military corps, you make a pledge of allegiance to the Constitution, not to a political party, not to an individual, not to a state, but to the Constitution of the United States. And that's at the core of the military sort of education system.
And that's reflected in the comments he makes.
Exactly.
I can only imagine what lunch is like with these retired generals talking about these things. But they very much are in tune to their oath to the Constitution. Very interesting.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder a bit of what's going on right now as these sort of purges are starting to take place.
Yes.
You know, as people are retiring or being forced out or not being, as just recently happened, not being allowed to move into general officer positions because of race or gender. And it's sort of like, wow, what is happening with the officer corps?
So, Bruce, give us some examples of how this plays out beyond what we've already talked about.
Well, I think, you know, for the most part, you know, the control of the military has always lain in the hands of the civilian government. And I mean, the two greatest examples in my mind come with Lincoln. When he pulls General George McClellan out of command of the Union Army in the Civil War, you know, McClellan was just a very, very cautious general. He had the Southerners in retreat, and then just sort of holds back and doesn't follow up, and loses this great opportunity to bring the war to a perhaps quick conclusion. And so Abraham Lincoln removes him, and then he tries a number of other generals until he hits on Grant, who's sort of the most unlikely leader of a Union army. But Grant was exactly what was needed. And Grant sort of just, you know, this war of attrition against the South that just ground it down and ended the Civil War. But the fact that Lincoln stepped in to remove the top military leader was very significant, and sort of the first time in American history that had happened. And then during the Korean War, when Harry Truman essentially relieves Douglas MacArthur of command of the Korean War, MacArthur at that point was sort of a demigod almost in American political system. I mean, he sort of won the Pacific War in many people's eyes, and sort of, you know, I shall return to the Philippines kind of concept. And
after five or six takes.
Yeah, yes. Right. Well, yes, yes, right, yes. But you know, he had this sort of reputation of being this infallible military leader. And during the Korean War, he had just consistently contradicted the Truman administration's stated policies about how the war was being conducted, the sort of outcomes that Korean War was looking for. He definitely wanted to invade China, and Truman saw that as sort of, you know, just way beyond the realm of what a military leader should be doing in terms of national policy, and so he removed him. And
do you recall who he replaced him with?
I don't, top of my head. I think, yeah, Bradley, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I was a kid in Washington, D.C. when that happened. And they had set up this great parade to bring MacArthur back. MacArthur was going to come back, and they're going to have these big ceremonies and big parade. And then Truman removed him. And so all they had was a silent motorcade of, you know, MacArthur driving through the streets of Washington, D.C. to be relieved of command by Truman. I mean, it was a somber time.
That would
time.
Be brutal.
It was. I mean, and it was very public. It was a very public humiliation for MacArthur. But it was that sort of reestablishment of that sense that the military is subordinate to civilian control. And the other thing that I think is fascinating is that nuclear weapons, I mean, the most powerful thing that we have in our military arsenal is not under the command of the military. It's essentially controlled by the Department of Energy, not the Department of Defense, or the Department of War, as it's now sometimes,
yes,
called. You know, so it's that sense that I think the American civilian government understands the danger of a strong military. And the military, up to this point, has largely understood their allegiance to the Constitution, not to political movements.
So let's move this ahead to modern times. And I'm thinking specifically around 2019, 2020, latter part of the first Trump administration, when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs began requiring subordinates to check with him. Bruce, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a time of uncertainty, particularly as we get to the 2020 election, you know, and again, that sort of, you know, here's an election in November, you know, the new president doesn't take over until the end of January. There's a three, almost 4 month period of sort of transition going on. And Miley, as a chief of staff, I think, comes out of that older military tradition of sort of being very, having great allegiance to the Constitution and being very wary of civilian leadership, particularly, you know, erratic civilian leadership. And so Miley begins to establish these connections with other powers, particularly the Soviet Union and China, sort of back channel, if you will, connections to mitigate anything that President Trump is doing. You know, and so what you get is that sort of pressure against that sort of who controls the military,
mm-hmm,
you know. And at that point, you have the Joint Chiefs of Staff sort of going back channel behind the president to sort of assure the Soviets and the Chinese that we're not going to do anything crazy. and sort of ordering his subordinates to come through him and respond to him rather than respond to political leadership. I mean, that's, you know, at the time it's a great thing, but in terms of the precedent it sets, it would allow someone who did not have their allegiance to the Constitution to respond to a political leader. I mean, Craig, you can see that the constitutional issues.
Well, I can see the intertwining, the multifaceted issue that you've got here. You've got potentially a president who is telling the military to engage in activities that are disrespectful of the whole concept of separation of power and the tenets of the Posse Comitatus Act, so what do you do if you don't have a legislature that's willing to rein in this one individual, and the courts can rein him in to a certain degree, but not on a day-to-day basis? As we know, the wheels of justice turn slowly. So what you then have is you have military officers, commanders, trying to take the lead, who may or may not respect the Constitution, but they're trying, some of them are trying to protect it on their own because nobody else is. And they're trying to maintain these divisions and these firewalls. And it really has shown its head in the concept of the use of the National Guard. The National Guard is the army, basically. The National Guard can be utilized to help and do various things, but again, it can't be used for law enforcement let me back up for a second. The National Guard can, if it's controlled by the governors, so you're at the state level, but it's when the federal government or a federal officer or a federal elected officer, like the president, steps in and says, I want this National Guard from Colorado to come into Minnesota or whatever the case may be to quell this, then you've got a direct conflict with the Posse Comitatus Act. There are exceptions, of course. If there's an insurrection or if there's a riot that's uncontrollable, then the theory is that the president might have that authority. But then we get into this whole blurred area of, you know, what is an insurrection? What is a riot? What is a situation where the state is unable to quell this activity so that the feds have to step in? Those are exceptions, if you will, to the Posse Comitatus Act. And then you take it one step further. If the president develops his own private army, which isn't addressed at all in the Constitution or in the Posse Comitatus Act, and I'm talking about ICE, of course, that's got the biggest budget of any law enforcement agency in the world, I think. Then don't you in fact have a army-like, you know, association under the control of the federal government that's being imposed upon the states in direct contravention to the spirit of the Posse Comitatus Act? Those are the arguments that are being made and have been made in court just fairly recently.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, particularly with ICE, you know, wearing military uniforms, you know, wearing flak vests, you know, wearing masks, you know, wearing helmets.
All the indicia, you know, of, I mean, army.
Yeah, exactly. They look like, you know, combat troops, you know, in Iraq, walking the streets of American cities. And that's where I think you get into very dangerous sort of territory.
So when I think of Mark Milley doing his back-end things, he's trying to assure China and Russia that we're not all crazy and everything will be fine. At the same time, I'm assuming he's trying to assure that they won't do anything crazy.
Yes. Oh, yeah. certainly.
Yeah. That's a whole other question.
No. I mean, on the international scene, I mean, chaos at home, in any country, is an opportunity for a countervailing power to move in or to make movements.
You invited me into a very interesting show here.
Yes, that's why you're here.
Right now, the Chinese are trying to become the great peacemakers in the world.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I mean, it's to fill that vacuum.
Exactly. Until Taiwan comes up, and then it's sort of, So we're in a very unsettled set of circumstances right now. And the fact that, you know, the Constitution basically provides for National Guards, you know, militias, state militias, basically. And those state militias are under the control of the state governors, unless they're federalized by the president, which has occurred. You know, I mean, Eisenhower did it in Little Rock, you know.
Bush did it in L.A., I think.
Yeah, for the L.A. riots, you know, they were federalized in Alabama. You know, to desegregate schools in Little Rock and in Alabama and again in Mississippi. But those have been the exceptions, you know, and what we're looking at right now is, are those going to become common practice? And that's the fear.
That's where we hope we have, I guess, calm heads might prevail. And I look at Senator Mark Kelly, recently taking on, I guess, signing their letter that about the right and indeed the duty to disobey unlawful orders among military. Obviously, he set off some landmines in that. But in fact, somebody's paying attention. And he paid potentially a price for that. But mm-hmm. we'll see how that all plays out in the courts and on and on and on.
There are proposals out there to tighten this whole relationship up, but there isn't the will in Congress right now to do anything about it.
Well, and I would, you know, we could, that's a whole other subject. I'm not sure what the will of Congress is at this point. You know, the idea of trying to get together and work bipartisan, I find that very frustrating personally.
Yeah. So, yeah, and bringing it all back to Vashon, we only have a couple minutes left. I mean, Vashon's sort of at the fringes of worrying about National Guards and worrying about federalizing the National Guard or bringing troops in into the island or onto the island. I mean, the only time there have been troops on the island is during World War II for the first time, and then during the Cold War with Charlie Battery and Anti-Aircraft Battery and then the Nike Battery. But essentially, Vashon is in a similar situation in that we don't have our own police force. So we are dependent on the county or the state to bring in police actions if we need them, or vigilantism. And there's a long tradition on Vashon of vigilante actions because we're so far from law enforcement. You know, and I look, when you look through the newspapers, In the 1910s and 1920s, I mean, there's constantly, or not constantly, but occasionally, what you get are these vigilante groups trying to trace down somebody who's done a robbery or somebody who's attacked somebody because you don't have police forces available. You know, and we've talked in the past about, you know, the rock concert on Memorial Day 1970, where a group of islanders formed their own armed sheriff's auxiliary that was sort of squashed by the sheriff eventually, but they were very worried about this rock concert, you know. And then, you know, what about 10 years ago now when the county was starting to put in rumble strips along the highway? We had a vigilante group of bicyclers show up and, you know, confront these construction crews, and it took a sheriff's bringing people from off island to settle things down. So Vashon is in that very strange sort of situation where we don't have a military, we don't have a police force, and so we need to resort, or we don't need to, but we often
we
do,
have.
Resort to vigilantism to solve these issues.
And with that, I think we'll probably see that happen again, but let's wrap it up. Craig Bellis, thank you for joining us today. This has been fun. We will have you back to talk about things like property rights and all sorts of
things.
All sorts of good things.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You bet.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.